from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. There are 8 Republicans seeking to succeed Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, who is running for governor. One of them is State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman, an Arnold Republican who has prevailed in crowded primaries before. Coleman joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about how she would transform the office and whether there will be enthusiasm to make the Constitution harder to amend in the next few years. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I am your host, St. Louis Public Radio's politics correspondent, Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from mid-Missouri, she covers all things state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us in St. Louis, she is one of the 8,000 Republicans running for Secretary of State.
Mary Elizabeth Coleman.
Actually, there's only 8, but it's fun to continually...
Well, plus some Democrats.
Yeah, so it is probably 8,000 at this point. So the last time we saw each other in the studio, you were running for the 3rd Congressional District,
yeah,
and you decided to switch to Secretary of State. What made you make that decision?
Sure. So the race for Congress felt really good from Missouri. And when you decide to run for really any office, you're looking at a number of things. But the biggest one is, where can you have the biggest impact? These jobs obviously come with a significant cost to your family. And where can you have a large impact, but also... you know, meet the responsibilities as mom and wife and practicing lawyer. And when the Secretary of State's race changed, I started to get a lot of phone calls about that race. And Chris and I had kind of decided that the congressional race made sense because although it was more days traveling overall, it was less days traveling during his busiest season at work. And so we kind of thought, like, having one of us home more frequently in the spring when it's the busiest was an equal trade-off. And then when it was really clear that there was a need for a candidate in the Secretary of State's race that had competence, had a conservative background and record of getting things done, not just somebody who fought and lost, but fought and won, and also who wasn't battling some ethical challenges, we decided that that was the right thing and to switch. And so went ahead and made the decision to switch races.
I always thought that you were going to be a prime contender for that congressional seat just because you have won.
Yeah, I think I would have won it. And that was the other thing, too, is there's something about it that makes you feel like, oh, no, I was going to be the dog that caught the car. And then here I am in D.C. in the middle of the muck and traveling to be away from my family. And like I said, the cost to these jobs is really high, and trying to figure out where can you best serve the community you love, but also, you know, be a mom.
What do you think you would offer as Secretary of State that is different from the 7 other Republicans running for the post?
Yeah. So when we're looking at the job and what is most important and what's paramount to people and their lives right now, Missourians are rightly concerned about the illegal immigration that's taking place. Governor Parson recently cited that there's 77,000 roughly immigrants, illegals who have come into Missouri. And we don't have anyone in the race who's focused on making sure that those guys aren't voting. Right now, our voter rolls do not have any system in place to check to make sure that that's the case. You just go to basically your library or your DMV to register to vote, and you check a box that says you're a U.S. citizen. And if you're willing to walk across the border illegally, if you're willing to break that law, why would you not be willing to break the law to vote illegally in the Missouri? And we do know that this is happening across the country by invitation by some of the electeds across the country. So whether that's in California or New York or Vermont, whether it's municipal elections or broader, Nobody is looking at our voter rolls. And so if Missourians are worried about who is going to make sure that there's no illegals voting in the state of Missouri and that our elections are secure from that illegal interference, then I'm the candidate that's focused on that issue.
Missouri has passed, you know, photo ID laws, other election laws in the recent couple of years, especially as I've been covering the legislature. So do you feel like that's done enough?
No, there isn't a mechanism in place. There is no audit of the voter rolls. If you were to ask any county elected clerk right now, are they certifying or checking that there are no illegals voting? They would have to tell you no, because there isn't a process in place. The Secretary of State's office doesn't have a way to do that. And so I'm not confident that we don't have illegals voting in the state of Missouri, and I'm going to make sure that we don't.
And how would, what would that look like? What would your policies look like to enforce that?
Yeah, so right now we'd have some audit processes in place. We'd be able to go in and make sure that people who have registered are U.S. citizens. As I said, our voter rolls right now, there isn't a way to check that. And that's largely a procedural and rulemaking authority to do so. We already have the laws that say that, it's illegal to vote. I think that that could be made stronger. My hope is that your listeners will vote in favor of Ben Brown's SJR 78 that makes it clear that not just all voters have a right to vote, but that only citizens have a right to vote. But we're going to put some processes in place to make sure that there's a way to audit the voter rolls and that we're certain that only citizens are voting in the state of Missouri.
So I actually was looking at the online form to register to vote yesterday, and you're correct. There is a question, are you a citizen of the United States of America? I would be very shocked if anyone answered no to that.
Right. Everybody's going to just say yes and click through.
And it does require a driver's license. If you don't have one, leave that blank. And the last four digits of a Social Security number, if you don't have that, leave that blank.
Nobody goes back and audits that.
But it also says that if you are making a false statement on a voter registration application, it may result in imprisonment up to 5 years or a fine up to $10,000.
But so does entering the country illegally. Mm-hmm. And so if you're somebody who already has shown that you're willing to flout the laws of this country and to create illegal actions, then why would you not do that as well?
Well, you know, we'll talk about elections in a little bit, but I do want to touch on the business registration and securities part, which seems to get less attention because I guess they're not as controversial. Is there anything in that space that you would want to do markedly differently than Secretary Ashcroft?
Yeah, so I would say that, again, when you're dealing with any business in the state, which means every small farmer has a registered LLC, you have to be top of customer service. Taxpayers have bought and paid for this office, and we want to make sure that it's run efficiently and that they have a positive experience and interaction. So there are some upgrades that were made to the website under Secretary Ashcroft's tenure, but I think there's more work to be done to improve that interface to make sure that it's user-friendly and people are able to get the information that they need quickly.
And what about securities regulation? And look, I'm not knowledgeable enough about the ins and outs of securities regulation to really know whether your plans are good or bad, but what would you do in that space to make people confident that you are making sure unscrupulous scams aren't like scamming Missourians?
Yeah, so I just want to start with, for your listeners that are pretty sophisticated, but securities is talking about the investments that people are making, moms and dads and families and savings, as well as large businesses. And so we're talking, when we talk about securities laws, not about physical security, but about securities, which is a negotiable instrument. They're a type of a document. They're traded. So the Secretary of State's office has investigative power, but not prosecutorial power. And so it's really important that they have strong relationships with the chief law enforcement officer in the state of Missouri. That's our attorney general. And so no matter who your listeners are going to vote for, whether it's Andrew Bailey or Will Scharf, I would say having really good connections and relationships with that office is paramount, because you want to make sure that the investigations and the information that they receive are going to hold up when that office goes to prosecute them. And so there has been some work in that area, but I think that there could be a better relationship between those two constitutional offices, and that would be my focus.
So let's get into a spicier topic, and that's libraries, which I never thought.
Who would have thought?
Well, I mean, I'm married to a librarian, so I know that libraries are the spiciest of topics. But perhaps an area where the Secretary of State has received more attention in than recent years is library funding. Now, I want to make it clear to people, the Secretary of State's office does not control local libraries. They can't necessarily, like, dictate the actions of local libraries, but they could certainly withhold funding and, you know,
so
prompt
the funding,
them.
Yeah, so yeah. The funding that we're talking about is there's a sports and entertainment tax that is funding our libraries roughly about 1-3%, depending on the year, across the state of the budgets for all libraries. So largely the Secretary of State's office does the funding through is really the administrator of a funding formula that the legislature wrote. And so I think there gets to be a little bit of confusion with book burnings and things like that. Local library boards are choosing to do things that people don't like. And this is one of the things that I would like to focus on is there has been some legislative changes that have been proposed. One in particular that I was really supportive of, which is making sure that library boards are an elected position. Because the reason why you're hearing this blow up or why people are so angry about the libraries is because they aren't able to have a direct say in the people who are making those decisions. And so they have taxpayer dollars that are funding things that their communities may or may not like. Now, there's some really spicy examples of that happening around pornography and access to inappropriate material for children. But there's also some communities, there's a library, for example, that's based along a Missouri River, and they allow you to check out canoes and kayaks and fishing poles. And there are some people who thought that was really inappropriate and some people who think that's fantastic, we should really continue it. But the problem is that there wasn't a board that was elected by people so they could decide, you know what, we like the decisions that were being made or they wouldn't. So the proposed change that I would make would be I would be advocating to the legislature, you know what, let's go ahead and find a way. Farmington, for example. Farmington is a library that's run by the city. There's just every single board structure that you could possibly imagine for the libraries. And the funding that comes that the Secretary of State is the administrator of is through that sports and entertainment tax. And it's done through basically block grants. And so that office has a certain voice about libraries, but really returning the power to the people to make sure that they're able to decide do they like or do they not like what their libraries are doing is the most appropriate.
Yeah. And look, I probably understand that some material and some books should not be like in the kids section. I think that even people who are quote unquote free speech absolutists would agree with that. And I think that's what basically the rules that Secretary of State Ashcroft talked about on this show a while ago were around. But I think that like my hesitancy is that like one person's inappropriate book could be another person's not inappropriate book. So is there anything that the Secretary of State's office should do to like define what is good or bad? Or do you think that that should be a decision on a local level?
So the Supreme Court famously tried to define pornography. And if you read the case law, it's really difficult to do so. And so I think that's what you're speaking to. But it's a very reasonable position of Missourians not to want taxpayer funding to fund pornographic materials, and certainly to not want any of that in the hands of children. And so I do support Secretary Ashcroft's rules that he promulgated. I thought that those were well written and within the definitions of the Supreme Court rules as they've struggled with what is and what is not pornographic material. But again, the heart of the problem is not one particular area that is really troubling, rightly so, to a lot of Missourians, but it's that there isn't a way to address it if you don't like what's happening. And so that's why I think getting the boards to be elected positions rather than appointed and making sure that there's a way for people to say, you know what, I don't like what you're doing, so therefore we're going to hire somebody else to do this job is the right way to handle that.
One of the ideas that's been broached in this campaign for Secretary of State is hand counting ballots instead of putting them through election machines. What do you think of this idea, especially since some people with experience as local election officials say this would make it much more cumbersome to count votes?
Yeah, and in fact, in countries that have done exclusively paper counting of or paper ballot countings, they have had just one issue on the ballot. So you'll hear a lot of times people will say, oh, they do it in other countries. They do it in other countries. They can't maybe answer which countries they do. But I've done the research and France has done it, but they've done it in presidential elections when there's been one question on the ballot. And so I think it's vital that we have paper ballots. We have to have paper ballots to make sure that if there is a problem, there's a trail that can be audited. I think that when there is a race that is within a certain percentage, being able to have the paper ballots to be looked at is really vital. And, you know, paper counting is only as good as whoever is counting those ballots. And so I think that the people who are insisting that we have paper only hand-counted ballots probably wouldn't really feel comfortable with Jackson County or St. Louis County doing, or even, you know, Boone County doing that counting. And with the 17 or 18 issues that are on a single ballot, the amount of manpower and hours, they probably also wouldn't really be comfortable funding that. And so it's important that we have the paper ballots. We want to make sure that if a race is within a certain percentage that we're able to do. Listen, what I would do is if there's somebody who's, there's a race that's within half a percentage, for example, I would call up each candidate or every candidate. If it's a race like the one I'm in, I'd invite everybody there. I'd invite the heads of both parties. I'd invite the media. And we would do it right in broad daylight. And we'd do a hand recount. And then we'd do a machine recount. And so I think you have to have both available. But insisting that one way or the other is better, my opinion is you should be doing both to make sure people feel comfortable with the results.
We'll be right back on this episode of Politically Speaking with State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman. And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman. She is one of eight Republicans seeking to be the next Secretary of State. I want to talk about absentee ballots. And one of the biggest changes during the Ashcroft administration was the implementation of an early voting period where you can go in person to a designated place and cast your ballot for any reason. What do you think of that system, and would you want it changed at all?
Yeah, so one of the problems that we had during COVID across the country was people had ballot harvesting, people had absentee voting for everyone, regardless of whether you wanted, and elections weren't an election day, but they were an election, you know, 10 weeks in some places. And I think it's important when we think about an election that we think, no, this is really who do the majority of voters want on the day that is the election. So I don't think that we should be having a broad range or an extended period of time. But the solution that was passed forward, which, by the way, every candidate who has served in the legislature voted and that was in office voted for the system we have in place right now, I did as well, was because there are times that people can't get to an election day on the day of the election. And so we had people lying, frankly, and we had no mechanism in place to verify whether they were really going to be out of town, whether their job really couldn't allow them to be gone for a couple of hours to vote. And so this creates a legal process that we know it's a limited period of time. It's not like many states that goes on and on and on. And we're not asking our electorate to come up with a reason that maybe we have no enforcement of whether they can or can't vote illegally.
Yeah, you read my mind. If you've listened to this show since COVID, one of my pet peeves is this excuse-based absentee system we have in Missouri.
I don't want the government making a decision about whether my reason is good or good enough.
But here's the thing. They can't prove that you were out of town. Yeah. They can't prove that you're incapacitated. They could certainly prove that, like, you were working on...
Well, you shouldn't be voting if you're incapacitated.
There's
a guardianship procedure in place. We want to make sure that people who are voting who have capacity. But yes, I hear your point.
On her point. My point is the excuse-based absentee system is a joke in this state. And the fact that it still exists is, frankly, bizarre to me. I haven't heard from a single election official on a county level who feels like it's effective or that it's necessary. And that includes Republicans and Democrats.
We have to have early voting because members of the military, we have people who are election judges, for example, who obviously can't vote the day of the election. Yeah. We have people who are very ill, who, you know, they can't come in public or because it would put them at risk. So there's a real reason that we need to have that. But my opinion is it should be for a narrow period of time, mm-hmm. and it should be left to the person to make the decision about what they think should happen.
So you would be in favor, for example, if you had like a 2 or 3 week period, you could request an absentee ballot, get it mailed to your house, and just send it back without checking off an excuse.
Yes, but my preference is that that's for as narrow of a population as possible, and that we have actually, and more likely that we have in-person absentee voting. I think that that's much more secure. I'm a big proponent of voter ID. I think we want to make sure, and that signature match process can be quite cumbersome for the county clerks. And so my preference is that period of time is broader for in-person absentee rather than mail-in ballots. I think mail-in ballots are really concerning for a number of reasons.
Are there any changes that you would make to how the state government's issued photo identification requirement is currently arranged, or do you feel like the way that it's structured has worked out well so far?
It's imperative that everybody who votes is able to prove who they are when they show up to vote. People want to make sure that there aren't people impersonating other people and, voting multiple times. And so I don't see a problem with the way that the system is currently working, and I think it's working really well. Everyone who votes should have to show a photo ID in order to do so.
You've already, on this show, expressed support for Senator Ben Brown's resolution that would ban non-citizens from voting. It also bans ranked choice voting. So what do you think of that part of the proposal as well?
Let's go. Everybody vote for it. I'm not trying to be flippant with short answers. When you have ranked choice voting, you're giving more than one vote to one person, and that fundamentally is unfair. And so I think pick your candidate and let the chips fall where they may.
And I want to get onto the non-citizen part. You probably have heard during the debate over quote-unquote IP reform that it's already illegal for non-citizens to vote. Like, can you just address that part? Because I feel like that gets brought up every time this proposal comes up.
Sure. So, and again, I know your listeners are really sophisticated, but IP reform means initiative petition reform, and it's the process for which we change either state statute or our constitution. And there is a concern, and I think it's a really valid concern, that we want to make sure that only citizens are able to vote. And right now, the state constitution says all citizens can vote, which is not the same thing as saying only citizens can vote. And so I think that's an important clarification, especially given what you're seeing in some other states across the country that are not just not having a process to verify the voter rolls that it's only citizens, but are actively inviting non-citizens to vote in various elections. And people don't think that if you aren't a citizen that you should be able to have a say in who spends taxpayer dollars, who votes to collect taxpayer dollars, and how those dollars are used or how the government is run.
So I have the most devilish of devil's advocate questions imaginable.
Let's
go. So I understand like, if you came into this country illegally, you shouldn't be allowed to vote. What exactly do you find objectionable about somebody who came into this country legally, has a green card, and wants to vote in local elections when they're paying taxes, they're contributing to a community, and they may want to say over who their mayor or their board of aldermen is?
Yeah, I would say that I'd encourage that person to become a citizen, and we would welcome them to become a citizen of the United States. When you have a primary citizenship of another or a single citizenship of another country, it means that your allegiance is first and foremost not to the United States of America. And I don't want people whose primary allegiance isn't to our country to be voting in our elections, period.
So to move to do some retrospective conversation now, you were in the middle of the effort this year to make the Missouri Constitution harder to amend, and it ultimately failed during the last week of session. What happened and why do you think it failed?
Yeah, so it was a little bit of a perfect storm. It was we had two of the longest filibusters. So for your listeners who may not know, that was actually my bill that I was carrying, and I fought for and used literally all of my political capital to try to get that across the line. I think it's vital that we make sure that our Constitution is harder to change. I don't think that you should be able to have just a simple majority to be able to pass a constitutional change. I think we need to make sure, like the federal system, that all areas of the state are represented. And so we had a proposal to say that, like the U.S. federal system, although actually easier than the federal system, that you have to have just a majority of the congressional districts to vote in favor of an idea in order to be able to pass. The conservative caucus, or excuse me, the Freedom Caucus, didn't like the order in which we were doing some other legislation, and so they filibustered for many hours, and then we finally were able to get through that passing the budget and the FRA, and then came back, and then the Democrats filibustered for a record length of time, and there just wasn't a path to get to a vote. So I know people would say, just bring it to a vote, just bring it to a vote. But nobody tried harder in the Senate to just bring it to a vote. And there was nothing that the Democrats were willing to trade a bill for, or to do this or to do that. That's one of the common ways that a minority in the state Senate is able to force changes on a specific piece of legislation, or if they can't change it on this particular piece of legislation, to get something else they wanted. There were a number of other proposals that they were really in favor of, like some child care tax credits, et cetera. But there was nothing on the table that they wanted that the majority was willing to give away in exchange with a different bill. And then at that point, the only thing that you could do is to make a motion to move the previous question. And that is a procedural move that is fairly unusual in the Senate and requires 18 senators to vote in favor of. And we didn't have 18 Republican senators who were willing to vote for that. Now, there were 10 senators who were willing to sign. You have to have 10 senators to sign the form to make the motion, but then for the motion to pass, you have to have 18. And so if I had brought forward the motion to move the previous question and it failed, that would have ended session and it would have killed the bill. And so there were people who really wanted me to do that, and I refused to kill my own bill. I think that protecting our founding documents is too important, and I wanted to make sure we had every chance to. So when it was abundantly clear that we had no path forward to get to a vote by getting the Democrats to sit down, and we had no way to get to a vote on the underlying motion because there weren't 18 Republican or Democratic senators who were willing to move the previous question, I made a motion to go to conference. That motion then was rejected by the House. The House Speaker rejected it out of hand. He could have just passed it. We had passed something out of the Senate earlier. I wanted to make sure that we had on the ballot that citizens only could vote. But because we had SJR 78 pass subsequently, we still had that. That is still going in front of voters. And so we could have had both IP reform and citizen only voting on the ballot. But, the Speaker chose not to bring, and the House chose to vote down a motion to send it to conference, and they didn't make a motion to pass the bill. They refused to do that. And so initiative petition reform died this year in the Senate, and it's really frustrating. Interestingly, last year, something very similar happened. We had a conference committee report that was all ready to go, and we just had one more vote that needed to happen. And so there's a number of reasons why we couldn't get to 18 Republicans, or why we didn't have the conference committee vote brought up the year before. And a lot of that is just everyone agrees that we need to make the Constitution harder to change, but not everyone agrees on how we should do that. And so when you don't have lockstep uniformity among at least 18 senators, you really can't push through anything in the Senate.
So you touched on this a little bit, in the Senate and the filibuster, that's been a dominant part of the story. But, months prior, the Senate did pass your amendment that would have made it harder to amend the Constitution, but it didn't have the additional language that the Senate Democrats were against. And I know that you advocated for that language to be put back on in House committee, but the House could have passed it without it. It could be, it could have been on its way to the ballot. So would you have rather had something
absolutely
than everything you wanted in that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, when I was in the committee hearing and I asked that get put back in, I am the candidate for Secretary of State that is running to make sure illegals cannot vote in our elections. And all of my legislative work was to make sure that illegals do not vote in Missouri elections. And so when I was in the House committee hearing asking that language be brought back in under my underlying bill, that language then later subsequently was passed in SJR 78. And so, we could have had both go onto the ballot. And I think that it would have been certainly preferable to doing nothing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the language that was on your amendment was, it was just non-citizens voting constitutional amendments, right? It wasn't on voting period?
Yeah, so because it was an Article 2 and not Article 11 of the Constitution, that's right. So actually SJR 78 is broader than what would have been put into SJR 74. That's right.
If you do become Secretary of State, do you plan to advocate to make the Constitution more difficult to amend?
Absolutely. Yeah, listen, we have got to protect our founding documents. Right now, we had this last year 128 initiative petitions filed with the Secretary of State's office. every single one of those has to be treated by the Secretary of State's office as though it will actually end up on the ballot, even though we know only a fraction of them will collect enough signatures to do so. And the amount of manpower to that office, and frankly, the amount of bad ideas that are never going to be implemented is really concerning. And so we should have a higher threshold. We've also accidentally disincentivized people to try to change the Constitution instead of the state statute. You have to collect more signatures, it's true, to be able to make a constitutional amendment rather than a statutory change, but not that many more in the grand scheme of things because you only have to have a 51 vote.
So that, you know, we had that question kind of asked to us on the Politically Speaking Hour of why are there so many efforts to amend the Constitution? And my answer was kind of, well, because if there is a statute change, there's nothing that stops the legislature from just making those changes right back. So would you support kind of bolstering any statutory changes that would be voted on by the people, maybe not having them be changed for a certain number of years with some limited exceptions? I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that the way that that's written is really important. A lot of times, so first of all, that was something that was offered over and over in negotiations trying to change. It was along with making Election Day a holiday, doing things that are broadly popular were things that were on the table as we were trying to negotiate an agreement. I think most people agree that it is too easy to change the Constitution in Missouri. How to fix that is something that we didn't agree on. And so when we're looking at, okay, should there be a period of time so that people don't just immediately have the legislature turn over their initiative petition that was just changed in state statute? Yeah, I'm certainly open to that. I will say, I'm a little bit cautious about wanting to make sure that there's some provisions in place that it's maybe, you know, and I get a little bit worried about intent laws, but practically speaking, things are almost always written in a way that need revising in subsequent years. Every statute that I have seen written in the state legislature has needed some sort of cleanup language. Senate Bill 190 is probably the one that is the most prevalent that you would be familiar with, which is making sure senior citizens don't pay personal property taxes. How do you do that needed some cleanup language. So I would want to make sure that we would still have a process in which people could clean that up to make it clearer. But yes, I certainly think that trying to make sure that the legislature doesn't just immediately override what citizens put on the ballot, I'm in favor of.
So this is a speculative final question because it would require a lot of things to happen. First of all, like, we don't know yet if the abortion amendment is going to be on the ballot. I think it probably will be, but I want to make sure that that actually is. But there has been some conjecture if that ends up passing in the fall, it may dampen enthusiasm to make it harder to amend the Constitution until that amendment is somehow changed or repealed. Because if you passed a threshold boost before repealing the abortion amendment, then it would make it harder to repeal it. And I understand that that is a convoluted question, but I guess the way to maybe simplify it more is the outcome of that potential vote on abortion, can you link it to whether, quote unquote, IP reform has a future or not?
So a couple things. First of all, I am one of the Republicans who's been saying loudly that the ability to make sure that our Constitution is solid and sound and free from interference from out-of-state interests goes beyond just the abortion issue. I know that that's not everybody's opinion, but my opinion is that there's a lot of other important issues like ranked choice voting, like Second Amendment preservation, like tax policy, that we want to make sure that our Constitution is sound. So I think it's important that it goes beyond that. I would also say, as a lifelong pro-life activist and as the most pro-life legislator in the legislature, I was able to pass defunding of Planned Parenthood this year in a year that had historically low number of bills. I was able to be the architect of the bill that ended abortion in the state of Missouri. And I'm really, really proud of that work. And I have done everything in my power and will continue to do everything in my power to stop the abortion initiative petition from getting on the ballot and then from passing if it does. So I just want to kind of start with those two caveats. There were some people who thought that if we made the initiative petition ballot changes in August, that it would apply to any November initiative petition.
Including
petitions.
Secretary Ashcroft, by the way.
Right.
Continue.
And I think that that's unclear, having read all of the Supreme Court rulings. I am not sure that the Supreme Court would apply those changes to initiative petitions that were already in process before that got onto the ballot. So I appreciate and respect the people who have that opinion. I just have a different opinion of that. I don't think that the Supreme Court would have allowed that, but it would certainly have been litigated either way. If abortion does become enshrined in our Constitution, I think you're going to see the state legislature immediately put onto the ballot again efforts to change that, to tap it down, to repeal it entirely. They're going to put something on the ballot. Missouri is a pro-life state. We had the first pro-life laws on the books back in the 1890s. And so to think that that would go unchallenged by the Republican supermajority, I think, is probably a little bit of a pipe dream from the pro-choice activists who are pushing for abortion on demand up until birth, which is what this initiative petition would do. So,
and they would dispute that, and they would say it doesn't go up till birth. They would say fetal viability.
But when you look at the reasons that you could have an abortion at any point, it says for a health or mental health reason. And so, and that decision can be made not just by a physician when you look in the reading. And worse than, so actually it's any medical professional's opinion that you could have any negative consequence of continuing the pregnancy, which would mean that it would be allowed up until birth if you had really, I mean, a hangnail, right? That would be litigated for sure. And then it also really eliminates all medical malpractice against doctors who perform abortions, or really any medical professional, if you look at that Article 5 language. So it is really extreme. It is not a return to Roe, and I encourage your listeners not to vote for it. But even if it passes, I don't think that that's going to tap down the desire to make it harder to change the Constitution. I think you're just going to see pro-life initiative petitions or pro-life ballot initiatives that are put on by the supermajority, and probably also continued efforts about to make sure that our founding documents are harder to change.
Well, Senator, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we have a number of other Secretary of State candidates to interview. I think, Sarah, that's going to take up a lot of our brain space and time for the next few weeks.
Sure is.
But we're excited because you're correct. This office is really important, and that's why we're putting forth the effort. So we thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me. And people can follow me or find more at MaryElizabethColeman.com or find me. I'm on all of the social media.
You know, you just short-circuited our last question,
which was
to ask you about where to find stuff about your site. So we'll do that. We'll let that go. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And you can read all of our coverage of Missouri politics and the 2024 election at stlpr.org. Thank you very much. Until next time, so long.